Okay, is this working? Yes. So last time we skipped two things on models and well, these were going to be models anyway for HCI. The first is the user action notation. Hello, it's here. Thank you. User action notation. The idea there was to find a way to have textual descriptions of graphical interactions. It's a notation, so it's not a theory, it's not a model. It's something that they found convenient, so they could talk about interaction in text documents. Now, why is this going off now when I'm in slide mode? Maybe I was not in slide mode, was I? Ah, that's why. Yes. So, notation, because we want to simply make it easy to write about things that are graphical without having to do snapshots. And even snapshots are not sufficient when you want to describe what is a drag and drop. Either you use a video clip or you use lots of words. And so the UIN is a way to note interactions in a concise way. So here the idea is you have the action. Is that the first slide? No, I think. No, it is the first slide. So here you have a notation where we talk about actions like clicking and dragging. So clicking the mouse is denoted by the M with the little V, meaning button down, and the little little hat there, meaning up. So mouse, down, up, that's a click. And then tilde is what they decided to use to denote that you're moving the cursor. And then after that, you put in square brackets icon to say moving the cursor to an icon, then I click, right? And then here you can describe feedback. So you can refer to icon, which is the icon that your mouse is over. And when you've clicked on the icon, it highlights, and they decide to use the exclamation mark here to say highlight, or with a minus sign, it says unhighlight. So this can say that when I click on an icon, essentially the icon highlights. I can actually write it a bit more precisely if I need to, if I want to, saying that actually the highlighting occurs on the button down, not the button up. Remember this discussion of down and up the other day? So here I can say, well, in fact, when I move the cursor into an icon and I click the mouse button, well, if there was the icon, if it's not highlighted, it does highlight, and all the icons that were highlighted unhighlight. So it's the traditional thing when you click on an icon. Now I can have a more sophisticated notations here. I can reference, for example, the positions, the XY position where I have moved the cursor. So I can describe that here it's a click and drag. I mouse down on the icon. It does highlight, sort of like in the previous case here. Then I move it from position XY, so it's as many moves as I want, up to the final move at position X prime, Y prime. Here I draw an outline of the file following the movement, and then at the end I release the mouse button, and then the icon stays where I left it. Now, again, this is just a notation. There is no, at this point, there's nothing you can really compute about that. It's a way to describe interactions in a textual way. This one is sort of the similar drag and drop, but here you can add a computation column if you want to explain something that's going on. So it's informal. It can be used, with a standard keyboard to describe graphical interactions. It's, well, easy to remember. At least you can easily document the various symbols that you use, and it can be extended if you need with new symbols, new columns, or new notations for the type of interaction you're talking about. Okay, something different now to describe interaction. which is closer to the way it could be implemented, is the notion of state machines. So a number of you have probably studied finite state automata. Yes, remember? Yeah, good old times. Well, these things are actually useful, believe it or not. So a state machine here is based on a finite state automaton. So a finite state automaton, for those who have never heard that term, is a machine like this. It has states. It can be in state 0 or state 1 or state 2. And then there's arrows that say I can go from state 0 to state 1 when there is this event that happens, which is clicking on an icon. And then I can go from state 1 to state 2 if I move the cursor and I move it here. There's a condition, a guard, that says I moved it by at least a certain distance, epsilon. And then if there is more move events, then I loop on state 2 here because I'm dragging the icon. And then at some point, I will release the mouse button. And so what's called the transition here, the arrow, on up takes me back to the initial state. And then I can down again, move. But if I'm in state 1 and either have not moved at all or have not moved enough, I'm staying in state 1, and then forget that arrow here. I don't know what happened. The arrow goes from 1 to 0. On up, I have clicked simply the icon. So with this three-state diagram, I can describe clicking and dragging the thing we call hysteresis, which is that a drag actually starts only if you've moved the cursor enough, right? Needless to say, so here what I've put in italics are the actions that are triggered every time you go through that arrow, through that transition. So when I hit the icon, I highlight it. Then as I move it, I drag the icon. I draw it at the new position. And then when I'm up, I move the icon to the destination, versus if it's just a click, I select icon, meaning I highlight it or show it as selected. In my experience, all regular interactions can be described with a state machine that is fairly simple. If you're starting having 10 states and arrows everywhere, there's probably something wrong. And what I found is that if you have too many states and transitions, maybe it works. Maybe it does what you want it to do. I'm not sure it's going to be very natural or intuitive or simple for the user, because it means there are many, steps and states and all that. So I find people have played with more advanced types of automata. So there's the augmented transition networks, the recursive transition networks, David Harrell's state charts, which are used in the UML standard. You can do state charts with states inside of states. Too complicated for me. Or even PetriNets, which is even more powerful and complex. I think that most interactions can be characterized by a fairly simple state machine, and in general, we don't need to go to that. The other thing with state machines is they translate very easily to an implementation. In fact, in our group, we developed this thing called swing states, which was state machines programmed in Java, working with a swing. The swing UI library for Java, which has now been superseded by JavaFX. But it's a nice model to describe interaction, to reason about it. Typically, every interaction technique should typically take you back to the original state at the end, so you can start over that interaction or another one. So you can reason about it, and it's also easy to go from there to the implementation. Questions? Yes, I thought there was a question there.
You showed that transition right there, so I wonder whether a transition could be bidirectional?
No. Well, no. No, I want to see it as two transitions, one from A to B, the other from B to A. Otherwise, I think it's probably confusing. If you had two transitions that are in reverse orientation with the same event and the same action, I prefer to draw two. I think it's easier to understand, and it reflects better what the interaction is. So the thing is, if by chance there were an exercise involving state machines in the exam, you never know. It has happened, so it could happen. The errors I see year and after year is to put things on these arrows that are not events from the input device, right? Typically, you can put an event and a condition, but it's the event that is going to trigger it. It's the fact that you've moved the mouse or clicked or crossed the border of the window or something that can be tracked by the input system, and then you can add a condition. If I only put the condition, which I see every year, it's not a state machine anymore. Your expectation when you do that is when this condition becomes true, then I jump, but that's not how the semantics of this thing works, right? So just think that the arrows have to have an input event and then an action and maybe a condition. Okay? So after that, so there was the whole GOMS thing that we went over last time. Then I had a slide here on instrument and interaction, but I've already bored you with that, so I won't get back to it. So I'll skip that. And then we get to the last short section of this overview of methods and models, which are methods and models from software engineering. So these are more on the side of how do I actually implement interactive systems and how do I organize the structure of the code or the structure of the user interface. Historically, the first architecture model that came out was called the Seeheim model. It's called Seeheim not because there is a Mr. Seeheim or Mrs. Seeheim. Seeheim is actually the name of a village in Germany where they had a workshop where they came up with that, and they called it the Seeheim model. And at the time, so this was done in the early 80s, where you typically had existing applications, and people wanted to put a nice user interface in front of it. So what is now called the functional core, but in the original model it's called the application, is the thing that does the calculation, the computation. It's what they call the application because it was like the important part. And the user interface was like this, you know, nice coat of paint on top of it. And they came up with this architecture that says that a user interface should be organized between a presentation layer that is responsible for displaying stuff on the screen in a graphical interface or putting out text in a command line interface and managing the input from the user. So that's why there are these two arrows here. Low-level output, in a sense, painting things, and low-level input, capturing input from the mouse. And then on the other side, we had what they call the functional core interface, or originally application interface, which is the part that talks to the functional core. So imagine your functional core is a database that stores, I don't know, a database of students with their grades or things like this. So you have probably, you know, some from the user interface, you want to have some SQL queries to the database so you can do things like give me the average grade of this class or something like this. So the functional core interface is the part that speaks to the application, but in a way that is meaningful and useful to the user interface. So on the one hand, this thing speaks to the user, this thing speaks to the computer, and then in the middle we put something that's called the dialogue control. Now, I have to tell you, this has always been a mystery to me, because essentially, they don't tell you what the dialog control looks like, and its role is to turn what's coming from the application like the results of a data query into things that you show on the screen, so into a displayable thing. On the other hand, to get input from the presentation layer, so someone has clicked something or someone has dragged something there, and turn it into doing something with the application, like launching a query or fetching the next page or something like this. But it says very little of how this dialog control works. Now, there were the main and most well-known successor to Seeheim was the MVC model. Have you heard of MVC?
Yes.
Now, I'll break some bad news. You've all heard of the MVC that is not MVC. MVC these days is not the original model. The modern version tends to be better than the original. But people put this label MVC on a lot of things that are not really what the original model was made for. It was implemented originally for the Smalltalk system. And the idea there was that it's an object-oriented system. And so we have objects on the screen, and then we have this sort of internal abstract objects that represent, in fact, the what I call the functional core in the Seeheim model. So you have this thing inside your program, and then you have these things that you want to show on the screen in terms of windows and graphics and all that. And so the things on the screen are typically the view, and the things that are the sort of inside the more abstract information are the model. And they created the classes in the Smalltalk system to represent the base class for all views, the base class for all models. And the controller is the thing in between. Now, the thing that you will see here is that originally the view was managing both input and output, which is a weird name because view seems to be output only. But the input is going through the view. In fact, there's a good reason for this, because to turn the input, the clicking or dragging or keyboarding, into something useful, you need the context of a view. You know, if you think of a scroll bar, am I clicking in the arrow? Am I dragging the little thumb? Am I clicking in the space in between? So you need the view to interpret the input. So the fact that the view is managing both is not such a bad idea. And then the controller is supposed to make the link between the view and model, so the input from the view gets interpreted by the controller to update the model. And then when the model updates, there is a notification mechanism so that the view is notified that, hey, the model has changed, you'd better update. And the view recalculates what is changed to update its view. Now, the big difference between this model and the previous one is that the previous one was monolithic. There was these three big boxes, and that was the whole application. In a MVC architecture, you have a bunch of these MVC triplets. For each object on the screen, typically, you have a view, and then you're supposed to have a model associated with it. There can be views without models and all that, but that's the basic idea. So it's the complete, no, I don't have a slide, but your system is going to be a hierarchy of MVC controllers. And in some cases, a view is simply the assembly of subviews, like you have the title bar, the content of your window, the scroll bar, etc. These are three views that together create a higher level view of, say, a document. Now, why do I say you don't really use the original MVC? Because, in fact, these relationships showed that they were not as flexible as people wanted. Typically, view, model, and controller were three classes for a particular type of content that were tightly linked together. And in software engineering, we prefer to make things that are sort of more decoupled from each other. So now you have variants of MVC, so there's MVP, Model View Presentation. Anybody? No? The common one at the moment is MVVM, which is Model View Model. That's tricky. Well, the idea is, when this came out, the view was created out of nothing. Yes?
Do you know the book Design Patterns?
Design?
Design Patterns. Because there are a lot of design patterns, but let me see, it's just quoted in the beginning. First
yes.
Part, and then not, no.
Yeah, the Gamma, the Gang of Four book.
Yeah, that one.
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course.
But the reason is because MVC now is outdated, so...
Well, but the book is old, so... yeah, and that's why there's been all these evolutions. And part of it is because at the time where this was made, the to create the view, you would do it from very basic graphics primitives, like drawing lines and drawing pieces of text. Now we build interfaces on top of a pretty rich view layer that already knows about things like lists and different types of graphics. So the MVVM thing is that you have the model and the view, but the view model replaces the controller, more or less, and it has information from the model that is needed by the view, plus sometimes some additional information that you need for the interface, but are not to be represented in the model. I don't have time to go into details. I think nowadays it's the choice of toolkit or UI library that you either have to make yourself, or more often that is imposed on you because your project is programmed with this type of framework or this type of framework that will force the particular variant of MVC that you will have to use. The key is, again, decoupling. We want to make it so a same model, for example, can be used with different views, right? So I have, for example, my file system is a model, my hierarchy of files, and I can have a view that shows it as a list, another view that shows it as icons located, you know, where I choose to put them, or a third type of view. So what we want is the model to be the ground truth, so that you don't change the view directly. You always change the model first, and then you propagate those changes. And that's the only decent way to have an interface, a user visualization that is always in sync with what's in the system. And all the variants of MVC sort of turn around various ways of doing this kind of both decoupling, but at the same time, strong coupling to make sure the view is consistent with the model. Yes? Okay. Now, there's been evolutions of these models. So this was the Arch model, which was more a step after Seeheim, where the idea that there's these three big boxes was updated to take into account the fact that there are interaction toolkits that were being developed more and more. So Java Swing was one, for example, now something like JavaFX. And so the presentation now is not talking directly to the screen, but it's talking to this existing component that is the interaction toolkit that already gives you predefined objects like buttons and menus and dialog boxes and all the basic building blocks of graphical user interfaces. And then the other side here, the idea was instead of putting the application on the side and then calling the REST user interface, the push was to say, well, we need to design interactive systems. We can't have an application or a system that is built, and then we are told, well, build a nice user interface for it. Because there are features of the interface that will affect the design of your computational element. So, a very simple example, Linux, Unix. Unix came out, Unix has a file system, and was designed for a command line interface. So in a command line interface, when I want to see what's in a folder or directory, it's called, I type the ls command and I get a list. And then 2 seconds later, I type ls again. I may get a different list if someone else has made a change, right? Now, in a graphical user interface, I open a window on this folder or directory, I see a bunch of icons or a list of files. Now, if someone makes a change to this list of files from another account, which is perfectly possible, I expect the thing on the screen to update. Now, in the original Unix and Linux file system, there was no way for the operating system to notify you when something changes. So what people were doing, the first graphical user interfaces for Linux, for every window you had opened, you had a process in the background that every, 100 milliseconds was doing the equivalent of ls, 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 ls to see if anything has changed. Needless to say, not very good for your battery. And also you could miss changes, in fact, because, you know, things can change quickly. So that's a case where the design of a very key component of, in that case, the operating system, was affected by the type of interface I wanted to make. And so in modern versions of Linux and all these operating systems, the file system component has a capability to send notifications. So a client program can say, well, I want to be told when there are changes in that directory. And there, the system, which knows when changes happen, can notify you so you don't have to do this constant polling. And so that's the kind of thing that the advent of graphical user interfaces have brought to the world of operating systems or application development. It's the idea that instead of having something that is a sort of a push model where you tell the system to do that, you tell the system to do this, and then it's up to you to figure out what has changed, we are more in the pull model where this system tells you, oh, this has changed, this has changed, this has changed, and then you are reacting to it or you are ignoring it. And so you need to know before you start building your whole application what are going to be the needs of the user interface to have a proper architecture. If you think of databases, you know, having a database that notifies you every time there is a change can be very expensive. So you will have to figure out what is the best architecture for this to be efficient and yet serve the purposes of the user interface. And so in Arch, the idea was that, you know, what's called now the domain-specific component was really part of the design of the whole interactive system.
Sir?
Yes?
For database, if a system tries to notify on every changes, then it can be disturbing user also.
Yes.
So you told the example for changes in the files?
Yes.
Maybe then over there I haven't seen it, that kind of user interface.
Oh, yes. Well, if you are, I mean, I'm on a Mac. If I'm on a Mac and then I have a window open and then I go in the terminal and I create a file in that window, an icon will appear.
In Mac?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's the same on Windows, I assume, and certainly on Linux.
Icon has appeared, but it is not notification, right?
No, it's not a notification. Oh, yeah, I see. No, it's not the bloody notification that, you know, pop up on your screen all the time saying, hey, you have a new message. Hey, you have a new this. Hey. No, it's a notification at the system level. Then at the user interface level, you can decide to pop up a window or to do it more silently, but to make sure that what's on the screen is consistent with what's behind the screen, in a sense, right? So, yeah, I have to be careful with my vocabulary now. Okay, so that's that. And then I think the last one I have here is the PAC model. The PAC model was created by Joël Coutaz, a French researcher from Grenoble. And essentially, it's what the modern version of MVC has become, which is sad because it's still called MVC, and she should get more credit for it. Now, you know, presentation, abstraction, control, you'll feel like this is very similar presentation to view and abstraction to model. And indeed, you know, one way or the other, we have to deal with this fact that we want to have data inside of our program and then a representation of it and keep those in sync. And the controller here is the obligatory way to go from presentation to abstraction and vice versa, which is the main difference with MVC. The other thing is that, unlike MVC, they have made explicit some some patterns for using this architecture, this SPAC architecture, for different types of system, including for collaborative systems or things like managing multiple views and things like this. So they have a set of heuristics to help you design your collection of PAC agents, as they call them, according to the needs of your application. So this brings me to the conclusion of this whole big chapter on theories and models for HCI. So HCI is a multidisciplinary field, so we borrow theories and models from other fields. I showed examples from psychology and from sociology, but there could be others. We are, of course, strongly linked with computer science because we build computer artifacts. So we borrow things from computer science as well when needed, like finite state automata. And then there's a number of models and theories that have been developed by HCI for HCI. And GOMS and instrumental interaction are two examples. What is important to remember about the role of theories and models is that they have to be at least descriptive, allow you to describe existing interfaces, existing systems. And most of the models, in fact, are just descriptive. But in science in general, we like models not only to be descriptive, but also to be predictive. Of all the models we saw, GOMS was somewhat predictive. But that's pretty much it. You can say Fitt's law is also predictive, but there is very few. And that means that since we cannot predict, we have to test. And that's why in HCI, user testing, running experiments, controlled experiments, field studies is so important, is because that's the only way we have to properly validate our ideas or our theories, because we don't have enough predictive models. And then they are rarely generative. What I mean by generative is that, in the end, creating interfaces, interactive systems, it's a creative work. It's design work. Designing in the void is very difficult. Generative principles like the ones we saw for instrumental interaction, the polymorphism reification, which I think you kind of practiced in the bootcamp a little bit. Yes? Yes, thank you. So these are generative, not in the sense that they generate automatically for you the solution. That's really not what it means, generative here. Generative in the sense that they help you to think of possibilities maybe more easily than if you didn't have any of these principles or guidelines. So if you say, oh, what does it mean to reify this? Or should this be polymorphic? And, you know, you can at least support the design process in that way. Most of the things I talked about in this whole section is from this book by Jack Carroll. His first name is John, but he's called Jack. Apparently, Jack is the short version of John. I don't know. So Jack Carroll, very famous HCI researcher, with this edited book covering a bunch of the things we've seen here. Okay, any questions on this? Yes?
So what do you mean by prediction?
Yes.
Yeah, you mean...
What do I mean by prediction?
Yeah, predict well, what?
Like, predict what? It can be different things with... Well, typically in HCI, we're interested in two measures of performance, which is time and error, right? So if I have two options to design, two possibilities for a particular design, I can either pick one or the other, and I can look at which one is faster. I also can look at which ones will make the users, or which one will generate more errors. The problem is that it's usually a trade-off. Something that can be faster can also generate more errors, and so which one do you prefer depend on external factors. Now, time and error are the sort of two classic measures, but nowadays there are other measures of quality, right? There's, well, did user liked it, you know? oftentimes, the user doesn't really like the one that is fastest. So there are other things that we may want to measure. And so predictive models would let us predict these measures without having to take 20 participants and put them in front of the computer and using a clock to see, you know, if they are indeed faster. We could predict this just by doing the math. But I think, you know, we shouldn't expect to have very powerful predictive models because this is human behavior. Human behavior is hard to predict in general, except for very simple tasks like pointing. Okay, well, this is driven by, you know, some basic motor control processes. But when it comes to making decisions or acting in a particular context, there are too many variables to have really strong predictive models. So I hope I were wrong, but so far that's been the reality. Other questions? Nope. Okay, so I will stop this.